third case for this morning is Boutros against Avis Rent-A-Car System. And we're ready for Mr. Michael.
May it please the court, counsel. This case simply comes down to a number of issues. The first of which is the evidence that was admitted in, that was hearsay evidence. I'm not here to tell you that evidence cannot be admitted for the truth of, for not the truth of the matter asserted, but rather the effect on the listener. What we're here to say is that this evidence was admitted in violation of Federal Rules 403 and 105.
But of course there's a very generous abuse of discretion standard of review for Rule 403 determinations.
I understand that, Your Honor, and the basis here is, you know, these statements that were admitted serve only for the purpose of discrediting my client, and they are extremely prejudicial and have very little probative effect in terms of the effect on the listener.
So, well, Mr. Michael, I actually have another procedural question for you. Are you familiar with Rule 30 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you didn't include in the appendix, the attached appendix to your brief, at least as far as I could find, all of the various rulings that you're appealing from.
Your Honor, if I may, what we're looking at in Rule 30 and what the case law cited by counsel indicates is that there needs to be a meaningful basis for understanding the trial courts or the district courts.
And so what I was looking for is, where did the trial court judge, I mean, there were like these little excerpts, effect on the listener, and so you've done something, but I'm not sure.
Circuit Rule 30A says the appellant shall submit, bound with the main brief, an appendix containing the judgment or order. And then it continues, or any oral statement of reasons delivered by the trial court.
Right. And
now,
so
your brief, you filed a certificate that you complied with that rule. Your brief does not comply with that rule. Appellees filed a supplemental appendix containing some of those things, but not all of them. And members of this court have had to track them down on their own. So part of the question here is how the court should respond to somebody who not only violated Circuit Rule 30A, but also falsely certified compliance with Circuit Rule 30A.
Well, I don't believe the compliance is false. I mean, what has been submitted to the court in terms of with the brief are, in fact, parts of the trial in which the judge re-indicated what his rulings were and gave some explanation thereof. So it does state what the judge's rulings were.
So you believe that your brief fully complies with Circuit Rule 30A and Circuit Rule 30B1?
Right. It does, in fact, have the judge's decision and his explanation, therefore, attached.
And
it's from the trial.
Quote, every oral ruling in the case that addresses the issues sought to be raised on appeal. Every one of them.
I guess it doesn't address everyone, but it does.
Circuit Rule 30B1 requires all of them, every single one of them.
Well, okay, I guess it is then therefore in violation of every single one, but it does.
But you certified to the court that your appendix contained all of those materials.
Then that was an error. It was not. It was not a. It was not a fraudulent by any means, but
so here's the problem. You gave us like two or three pages here and there, but a Rule 403 ruling, which is what you started out, and that's why I wanted to talk about this a little bit by saying you're making, is a very sophisticated ruling. It looks to see what's the probative weight of the evidence, what's the possible prejudicial impact. It needs to be assessed against the background, really, of the full trial. How strong was the evidence? Maybe it didn't make any difference. Maybe it was overwhelming compared to everything else. It's, I would say, virtually impossible for us to make an intelligent 403 determination with just the one paragraph where the judge says, I'm denying your motion to exclude this evidence because I think it can come in under 403. I mean, fine, you know, we can see that that's how the judge ruled, but you're asking us to assess that ruling.
Well, Your Honor, I think that what we're looking at is just simply a statement by someone who is not an expert, as the court delineated in its limiting instruction to the jury. But what we have are facts sufficient to show that this person submitted evidence of what his reasoning was. He said that this fire extinguisher could have only released 5.5 ounces, which is,
well, he does some things. You know, he mentions that on the label it says that the weight of the full extinguisher ranges from 9 pounds 5 ounces to 10 pounds 1 ounce, and so he just weighs the discharged extinguisher. It turns out to be 9 pounds 11.5 ounces. So that doesn't leave very much possibility for discharge.
Well,
I mean, I don't know that you really have to be an expert to figure that out. It just says on the label.
Well, actually, that's exactly the issue, because we don't know what the density of this powder is. I mean, powder, as we know, I mean, a little bit of powder doesn't weigh very much. I mean, it could, you know.
But apparently this just settled down into a little pancake.
Right, it settled down into a little pancake, but there was also evidence that from one of the defendant's witnesses that it also stretched out all the way to the end of the bus. So what we know is, you know, we don't know what the density of this is. We don't know, we don't have anyone who could have rebutted this. You know, this person who comes in is not an expert, you know, and is told to the jury he's not an expert, but he has years and years of experience dealing with fire extinguishers.
I don't know why he wasn't qualified as an expert, to tell you the truth, because it seemed to me under Kumho Tire, you know, you don't have to be a PhD in something to be an expert. If he'd worked with fire extinguishers his whole life, maybe he was an expert.
Right, and that's our argument. If he had been qualified as an expert, perhaps there would have been a rebuttal
expert.
You
would have been worse off, wouldn't you?
Well, there would have been a rebuttal expert to show, you know, number one, you know, that we don't know exactly how much 5.5 ounces is. You know, 5.5 ounces of powder, I mean, the density of it is at issue. I mean, secondly, what we have is, we don't even know if it's the same fire extinguisher. This person couldn't have been cross-examined because he didn't show up. So all this guy is showing up doing and telling us is that we are basically looking at someone who said, you know, this is a small amount, but we don't know if it's the same fire extinguisher. We don't know what that fire extinguisher weighed upon being full. We just have a general idea. I mean, there's certainly
lots of other evidence in this case. I guess I want to go back, you know, to the extent we can do this, to assess whether it was an abuse of discretion to let this in, effect on the listener, not for the truth of how much powder came out or whatever, but this is what they were told. Same thing is true with the Sappington statement. There was a lot of evidence about what happened.
Right. No,
where it happened, you know, where the bus was at O'Hare.
I understand, but you know, the primary resting point of Avis is such that, you know, they're claiming they terminated him based on his inconsistency. And, you know, at trial, you know, the best...
Well, they, as I read this, sort of cutting through it all, they're terminating because they thought at the time that he wasn't being honest with them about what happened on the bus, and he gives this dramatic account of illness and everything, and it just isn't honest, and they don't want him working for them for that reason.
Well, you know, this goes back to, you know, if we look at the emails that Avis had sent, you know.
I know there are other emails. They don't like him very much either, but that doesn't mean that you get to be dishonest.
Well, I'm not saying he gets to be dishonest, but if we look at what, you know, William Rogers, a regional manager at Avis, his own testimony, I mean, which I cite in my brief, you know, they were questioning him as to what exactly was, in fact, inconsistent. And, you know, he's stating first he said, well, he didn't know how it happened, and then later he surmised maybe a customer hit the fire extinguisher. So the evidence they're claiming he changed his story, but really all he was offering at the second time he was being questioned was he was offering a possibility. He was still saying, I don't know. So the basis for his alleged inconsistency was just offering a possible explanation.
But it was a very... I'll say unlikely possible explanation if the bus was empty at the time the fire extinguisher actually fell off.
No, but I mean, if a customer had hit it getting off the bus earlier, then it possibly got loose, and then when he was making a right turn, then it possibly fell off. So, I mean, it's just, I mean, he doesn't have to be, you know, a genius by any means, or he doesn't have to be right. I mean, he's just offering what he's guessing to be a possible explanation. So,
but
it's
they
not,
didn't have to, this isn't about whether they were right to terminate him. It's about whether they were in some way terminating him for an impermissible reason. And being wrong about their assessment of what exactly caused the accident to happen isn't invidious.
I understand, but what they're saying is he was inconsistent with his previous testimony, but all he did was offer a possible explanation, which is not an inconsistency, because first he said he doesn't know, and then he said, I don't know, but maybe I'm surmising that this is what happened. And that's what they're alleging the inconsistency is, and that's, you know, that's quoted straight out of the trial transcript by their regional manager, who offered perhaps the best explanation as to what the inconsistency was. So, I mean, if that's what they're claiming the basis is, in light of the other emails that are stating, you know, we hate that we had to bring him back, etc., this guy is a liar. And they claim, I mean, and then there are times where they're claiming that they made a decision, you know, a week later, you know, that they had
How does any of this discussion establish an evidentiary error?
I'm sorry?
You're getting into the weeds here, but, what we've got is a claim of evidentiary error. So,
right.
Why was it error in violation of the rules of evidence to admit this evidence?
Well, because it's more prejudicial than it is probative. So what we're saying here is...
Why? I mean, I have the same question Judge Sykes does, really, about both of the evidentiary complaints.
Because these are witnesses who are directly attacking the credibility of Mr. Boutros, and by doing so... All it does is make him look. It makes it look to be that his version of events is not plausible, and that's exactly.
But you've already explained that you offered the a different reason why even a rather small amount of discharge might disperse in a very irritating way.
Right, and so.
So it's not even inconsistent with what Mr. McCartney said.
Well, right, exactly. But these people should be able to be cross-examined. I mean, this is hearsay. This is evidence that's coming in without the possibility of cross-examination. I mean,
I thought you conceded that it wasn't. It was being admitted for the effect on the listener, but your argument was a 403 argument, which is that even though it's admissible, the cost, in a sense, is too high.
I said that that type of evidence could be admitted, but because the effect on the listener, I mean, this person was hired to write, you know, a six-page line, but then a six-page handwritten note, you know, explaining his reasoning. But and Avis is claiming they relied on this, but at the same time, you know, this is just serving to make him look not credible in front of the jury, and therefore side with Avis.
Well, he was fired for dishonesty.
Right,
to defend that basis against a claim of. Retaliation and a claim under Title VII, the company is entitled to support its basis for that. And yes, that's going to have some impact on the jury's view of your client's credibility.
Right,
but that's just sort of the nature of the beast that's the reason for the firing.
But when you're looking at what was written by this expert, I mean, like I said, there are alternative possible explanations for why that small amount was discharged, and so because it's hearsay, he can't be subject to cross examination.
We know that. If you want to save any time for rebuttal, I would advise you to do that at this point.
I will do so now. Thank you.
Because I think you've made those points already, Ms. Ramsey.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Amy Ramsey, and I represent the appellee, Avis Rent-A-Car System. There are really two categories of issues here. The first category is the category of issues and arguments that the appellant has waived by simply not properly raising them before the district court. The first of those is the alleged evidentiary issue about the amount of evidence that was permitted to come in regarding the plaintiff's prior lawsuit against Avis.
He didn't mention that. I mean, there was the stipulation that he had that I gather everybody agreed to at trial.
That's absolutely correct. In the brief, Mr. Boutros presented this as an error by the district court by limiting the amount of evidence that he was permitted to introduce about the prior lawsuit. In reality, it wasn't a limiting ruling by the court at all, but it was a stipulation arrived at by the parties. So that is an issue that the plaintiff has waived by not properly objecting to it before the district court. The second waived issue that isn't properly before the court are all of the arguments that are made with the allegation that the verdict is against the weight of the evidence. The plaintiff filed a post-trial motion under Rule 59, and it was virtually unsupported. There was no explanation of why.
You allege this was just kind of a placeholder motion.
Correct.
A placeholder. To be filled in later.
A placeholder that the district court concluded wouldn't allow the court to provide an extension of time, that being prohibited under Rule 6B. So the court ruled from the bench, based on the information before it, which was there is nothing offered here as grounds for finding that the jury's verdict was against the weight of the evidence. So that motion was denied. Now on appeal, what the plaintiff appellant is putting in the brief are all of these reasons why, and to Judge Sykes' point, why, you know, why are we hearing this, all of the reasons why the jury allegedly got it wrong, but none of that was raised to the district court, and I submit that none of that is properly before this court. That gets us to the evidentiary issues that were discussed somewhat at length. Those are, as we've discussed, reviewed under the abuse of discretion standard. It was certainly not an abuse of discretion for the district court to allow Avis to explain what it was in its investigation file after the fire extinguisher incident that informed its decision to terminate his employment. There are two such statements that the plaintiff is taking issue with. One, the Dane McCartney statement, who's being characterized as an expert by the plaintiff.
Is he Dane or Dave?
It's Dane McCartney.
Okay. There's some inconsistency.
Yes. And Mr. McCartney is not an expert. He did not file a report. He was not qualified under Rule 702. The plaintiff objected that he may be misconstrued by the jury as an expert, and the district judge ameliorated that by specifically instructing the jury that he was not an expert, he was not qualified as an expert, he did not appear at trial. His only appearance was through two out-of-court statements, a six-line email and a six-line handwritten statement, not six pages as was represented by the plaintiff. And they merely stated some pretty basic information, which is this is how much it weighs when it's full, based on the label. This is how much it weighs now. We don't think very much discharged. And that was pretty much it. Now, plaintiff has made much ado about he can't be cross-examined. Well, there was nothing preventing him from calling Mr. McCartney as a witness and asking him about this exercise, and they declined to do that. So certainly no abuse of discretion in the court allowing that in. The next piece of evidence that the plaintiff claims was admitted in error is the Ricky Sappington statement.
So why wasn't Mr. Sappington called?
Mr. Sappington was identified as the plaintiff as an individual who could corroborate how ill he allegedly was the night of the incident. So his original claim was that Mr. Sappington saw him vomiting in the parking lot the night of the incident. Avis investigated that, and Mr. Sappington denied having witnessed this.
Was he another employee?
He was a coworker, yeah. Correct. Yeah. He provided a written statement to that effect, which was in Avis's investigation file, and it relied on that. At trial, the plaintiff was impeached about Mr. Sappington because at his deposition during discovery, he denied ever raising Mr. Sappington, ever claiming that Mr. Sappington saw anything, including this vomiting, and then he was impeached with that when he reverted to his original position at the trial. So certainly, even if there were error in admitting Mr. Sappington's statement, which again was not offered for the truth, it would be harmless error because the plaintiff damaged his own credibility on the issue on which he was impeached and on many others identified in our brief. And those are the two categories of issues that we see as being presented in this appeal. And unless the panel has any questions, I'll return my time to the court.
All right, apparently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think you saved a few final words, Mr. Michael, so you may offer them.
Once again, Your Honor, The stipulation that was allegedly entered into, although...
Allegedly?
What's alleged about that?
Well, Your Honor, the stipulation was entered into, but what happened was, if I may read from the transcript that that Avis has provided, on page 22 of their appendix, they cite... page 22, the judge starts going at the bottom, starts going into what is and is not relevant, and then at the bottom of page 23 of their appendix, Mr. Glass, the trial counsel, asks, "Is the court directing the parties to work out a stipulation as you just outlined it?" And the court said, "Essentially, yes. If you don't work out a stipulation, then you're going to have to present the evidence, but the evidence is going to be circumscribed as basically as I have just outlined it. I can't conceive of why the parties wouldn't be able to reach a stipulation." So, in effect, the judge is ordering them, this is what it is, or else I'm going to make it this way. So this amounts, or it's tantamount to an order of what it is, and thus basically Mr. Boutros' hands were tied at this point that he had to stipulate. I mean, this could not sound more like an order, even though it was allegedly reserved by the judge. He's saying, if you don't work out a stipulation, then it's going to be circumscribed basically as I've outlined it. So he's basically saying what is going to be done. So it amounts to an order. As far as the skeletal placeholder nature of the Rule 59 motion, essentially the case law that is cited by Avis, what we're looking at here is case law where the Seventh Circuit has held that they are not responsible for gathering the facts. It doesn't talk about what was argued at the district court level. The argument was preserved at the district court level to be then subsequently made again on appeal. And oftentimes, as is the case, a lot of arguments, once an appeal is being written out, is often far more fleshed out than it is at the district court level. And the case law in each one of those cases cited by Avis refers to a skeletal argument made in the Seventh Circuit brief. So,
okay. All right. So thank you very much, Mr. Michael.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement. Thanks as well to Ms. Ramsey.